This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with noted Zionist critic Joel Covell, professor at Bard College who was recently let go from his post there.
20 years of teaching. We will ask Joel, did politics, particularly your politics of anti-Zionism, play a role in your termination?
We'll talk with attorney Scott Horton about several documents that were recently released from the Bush administration.
If we were worried about the fascism blueprint before, you should really be worried now. These documents allow the military to bomb your house, get rid of the First Amendment, in other words, suppress your free speech, get rid of the Fourth Amendment so that they can go wherever they want with impunity. Pretty serious stuff, and Scott's going to tell us all about it.
You'll remember the case of Ali Saleh Kala Al-Mahri. Well, he was recently indicted on terrorism charges.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing? His case is over, at least for a while, as an enemy combatant. But did Obama get rid of the entire Bush policy? Jonathan Heifetz will tell us.
Stay with us.
We're really happy today because we have our fourth host with us on the telephone, Dalia Hashad, from Amnesty International in Washington, D.C. To begin with Dalia, we're going to have Dalia give an update on Proposition 8. Now, it's unclear to me why we need an update, but Dalia is going to tell us. Proposition 8, you remember, is the anti-gay marriage California resolution that passed California. Is that right, Dalia?
Right. The quick history is in May of 2008, the California Supreme Court struck down two existing laws in California saying that same-sex couples could not marry.
That meant that the laws that said gay couples can't marry or same-sex couples can't marry were struck down, and that meant they could marry. Is that right?
Yeah, really what the law said was marriage is between a man and a woman or between members of the opposite sex. And so what happened when the court struck that down and said that the Constitution, the California state constitution, guaranteed the right to form a family, have relationships between individuals, whether they're gay or heterosexual, and that can't be denied. So about 18,000 same-sex couples got married in the state of California, and you saw Proposition 8 on the ballot very quickly in this past November, November 4th, 2008. And what that said was very simply that marriage is between a man and a woman. Now, this issue is really interesting because people have been talking about Proposition 8 as if it's just a gay marriage issue. This is not just about gay marriage. This is so much more, and the court case will really tell that story. This case is about the right of a majority of voters to decide to deny fundamental constitutional rights to a minority group.
Let me see if I understand that. This is why we actually have constitutional rights like the amendments to the U.S. Constitution. It's really because of the worries about the tyranny of a majority that would take away minority rights. Is that the way I look at it?
That's exactly right. The Constitution is there in part to protect minorities against the majority. And in this case, the California Supreme Court is hearing whether or not the voters impermissibly denied a constitutional right or voted away a fundamental right from a minority group.
Has this ever happened before in California?
This is the first time.
Okay.
So you really saw, I think, while Proposition 8, while up until November and the run-up to November, this was really an issue in the media about gay marriage, and that's really how people decided it. And unfortunately, now that we're past November, I think we're looking at the correct way to talk about this. And the correct way to talk about this is not about an issue of marriage or gay marriage. This is really about an issue of whether or not the majority, by 50% plus one, gets to decide what fundamental rights we get to take away from minority groups. You know, the majority of people in California will soon not be white.
What you're saying is Proposition 8 essentially did amend the California Constitution because that Constitution had been interpreted by the court to say gay marriages, same-sex marriages are permitted. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, I got it.
That's right. It said that even though it is a constitutional right for anybody, whether they are gay or straight, to get married, we as voters are going to take away that right.
I don't see how this could stand up in court, Dahlia.
Well, I don't either, but, you know, Ken Starr, who's arguing, he's, you know, as people remember, he's the dean of Pepperdine Law School, and before that...
He was the special prosecutor.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
he was a special prosecutor.
A sex crimes prosecutor,
he's a,
right?
He's a sex cop, and he's rallied all these right-wingers.
He showed up at NYU Law when I was there teaching a class, and he's been, you know, he's dean of Pepperdine Law School now, but he really has made himself very available to extremely conservative causes in the religious right, trying to do their bidding.
So this case is now before the California courts, Supreme Court?
It was heard on Thursday, the 5th of March. So that would be just a couple of days ago. The day before, on Wednesday, there were rallies all across the nation in the evening supporting equal rights for everybody. There was a candlelight vigil that evening, and on the day of the court hearing at 9 a.m., there was another rally outside the courtroom in Sacramento.
Dahlia, I know that State Attorney General Jerry Brown is challenging this on the issue that you raised, that you can't reverse the Constitution on a fundamental rights issue. And I read that Starr has accused Brown of overreaching in his legal argument.
Yeah, well, Jerry Brown, that's correct. Jerry Brown, the Attorney General, has been very supportive, and he is asking the court to invalidate Prop 8, basically on the grounds that you have these certain fundamental rights, and the right to marry is included in that. These are inalienable. You can't put them up for majority vote.
The question for me is, there is obviously ways to amend constitutions to deprive people of fundamental rights. So, for example, if in the United States, if in the federal government, they could try and eliminate one of the aspects of the Bill of Rights, they could go to Congress. They could get, I think you have to get both houses of Congress, maybe, I don't remember, three times in a row or something like that, or some majority, and then it has to be ratified by three-quarters of all the states. It's a huge process. It takes many years. And then the question would be, if they did that, if they took away a so-called fundamental right out of the Constitution, what would happen to that? Would the Supreme Court look at it and say, well, this is, you can't do this? And they could argue that it's so embedded in the Constitution and our history that you actually couldn't do that, even though it passes the process. It's an interesting question. What you guys seem to be saying here even more, though, is you simply can't have a fundamental right in the Constitution, put it up for a popular vote, and that's the end of the matter. It's not a process that should be allowed to work. Heidi, I understand we have some news. For the few of our listeners who actually use stamps, that there's something they can do that asserts at least something positive about America.
You're right, Michael. Just a little over a week ago, the U.S. Postal Service released a series of six stamps, and on each, they have the portraits of two civil rights leaders, including Ella Baker, Daisy Gates and Bates, Ruby Hurley, Medgar Evers, and Fannie Lou Hamer. It's a wonderful thing to do when you send those letters.
Can you get these stamps right now?
The stamps are available now, and I'm going to go out and buy my special supply.
Excellent. I want to give a short sort of commentary update on prosecutions, truth commissions, and the like. This is a debate that's just been going on and on in this country, particularly in liberal groups, but others as well, as to whether we should subject Bush employees, Bush high-level officials, including Bush, to criminal investigation and prosecution, or whether we should do nothing, or whether we should have truth commissions. It's heating up a lot. This last week, Senator Leahy is holding a hearing on the establishment of a truth commissions. I would call it a lame commission, not a Leahy commission, because this is the one in which the Democrats, the so-called liberal Democrats, or some of them, buy into the sort of politics of Washington, in which they say, well, we'll just hold a truth commission, we'll give people immunity, and we'll find out what happened. Well, that's not enough. That's basically a grant of impunity to the torturers. As you'll see today when we interview Scott Horton on this show, more and more is revealed about the nastiness, the illegalities, and really the creeping fascism of the last government. To fail to prosecute in these situations would really be an outrage and would send a message to the future and to future presidents and others that you can violate the law with impunity. So it's really time. It's really time to say to the Senator Leahys of the world, truth commissions are not enough.
Since author and professor Joel Covell published Overcoming Zionism, subtitled Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, he has endured accusations of anti-Semitism. Michigan University Press banned his book and only restored it after a huge defense campaign. And just recently, Joel was terminated from his teaching position as a professor at Bard College. Joel Covell is with us on Law and Disorder to give us an update on his struggle for academic freedom. Joel Covell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm happy to be back.
Joel, can you tell us what happened in the lead-up to your termination from Bard?
Yeah, it's a long process because I had this contract which expires in July, and they had a valuation which took place last fall. And I can go back and review that a little bit later if you like. But the basic timeline is that I met with a underdean, so to speak, and asked him to meet with the overdean. And I said I would like to, you know, talk about my next contract, and did so in a very friendly and amiable spirit. We set an appointment for that for February 10th, and on February 7th, I received a letter saying that they decided to terminate me. In other words, they didn't want to sit down and talk with me about it because, with some ambivalence, had decided on having an amicable separation, not because I like things there, but because I had a long relationship with them and it's hard to just break off. However, they chose the hardball route, and I met with the dean, and even then we said, well, maybe we should talk to the president, President Botstein. I said, that would be good. And she said, all right, we'll set that up, and I left on that basis, but didn't hear from them at all for a week, and then I decided, well, this has to be another route, and I just released this statement to documenting the kinds of difficulties I've had over the last 7 years since I began public and national criticism of the State of Israel. But this was, you know, a new departure for me, and I've been in trouble with Bard since then.
Joel, can you tell us what makes you think that your termination from the college is related to your advocacy? Yeah.
Well, of course, there's no smoking gun unless it turns out that something in that evaluation process went seriously, you know, awry and was foul play or whatever. But it's just a series of circumstances of being terminated from an endowed chair that I held 3 weeks after I published an article critical of Israel, Zionism, and being asked to resign 3 weeks after I published another article critical of Zionism. Feeling a very cold shoulder. All campuses, or most any in this country, are highly Zionist in organization, but Bard is exceptionally so. The president is a conductor of the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. He said he makes 10 trips a year to Israel. He has virtual, some kind of official, semi-official status. And he brought them around, and they had a concert when I was away in which they played the national anthems of Israel and the United States, and the audience all stood, which I thought was just outrageous. I mean, it's like my co-members here are making a face, as they should. I mean, any rational, sane person of goodwill would say, wait a second, these are separate countries. What are we doing standing for their two national anthems? I tried to give a lecture on that and was basically shunned. You know, calling attention. And then my book, Overcoming Zionism, was eliminated by the University of Michigan Press because of pressure by the Zionist lobbies in 2007. I received no support from the presidents of the university, of the college.
Some of our listeners will remember that you were a previous guest, and they can go back on lawanddisorder.org and listen to your previous interview.
Yeah, we talked about that.
But for those who haven't, can you tell us a little bit, just summarize quickly?
The book was published in February of 2007 by Pluto Press and distributed by the University of Michigan Press in the United States, because Pluto is a London publisher. And the book was called Overcoming Zionism, and it takes a firm line, and a line that I regard as absolutely necessary, namely that one doesn't just talk about the occupation or Israeli abuses or this and that, but one talks about the fundamental structure of the Israeli state, which is animated by Zionism, which leads to all of the woes and the abuses in human rights. And unless you deal at that level and point towards an overcoming, not just of Zionism, but of course of the special status of the Israeli state, and you treat Israel the way we treated South Africa for equivalent crimes in the apartheid era, namely systematic racism against an indigenous people, a neo-colonial settler, neo-colonial entity, and it's time to face up to that. So in other words, it was a ruthless criticism, as my old teacher Karl Marx said we all should do, engage in ruthless criticism of everything existing. So I started catching hell from the Zionist lobbies. I'm anti-Semitic, I'm full of hate, and shoddy scholarship. Nobody ever introduced any proof of this, but they just screamed and basically panicked the University of Michigan Press, whose director then pulled the book and banned it. And we organized the group, Committee on Open Discussion of Zionism, at that point in the summer of 07. It's still going, and it's been mobilized in this struggle also. It's CODZ.org, and everybody is invited to look there. There's statements on it. It's growing, and we're going to be announcing all kinds of things on that site. So keep it in mind, CODZ.org. In any event, when that banning took place, which is by any standards outrageous and a clear example of the kinds of repression that the Zionist lobbies impose upon people who dissent from the unholy relationship between Israel and the United States, lots of people were mobilized. We got 650 letters. We were very successful. But it was remarkable that Bard College, which is very, very proud of its image as a bastion of defense of freedom of speech, supposed to be the second most liberal college in America, United States, I kid you not, according to the Princeton Review, wow. They did nothing. Not a single peep from this bastion of free speech. So I knew that we were in serious straits at that point. I've put up an anti-Zionist course last fall, and with some resistance, and I knew there was trouble, and the faculty review committee, which evaluated me prior to the matter of my contract and whether it was going to be continued, was headed by a man named Bruce Chilton, who was the chaplain of the college and is a Christian Zionist of very, very serious proportions. He's very much involved in struggling against the anti-divestment movements within the Protestant churches. And I'm involved in struggling for the divestment movements in Protestant churches, among other things. He was on the air last January on WABC Radio, which is a very right-wing talk radio program supporting the U.S.-backed Israel destruction of Gaza, and calling it an instance of the theory of just war, which he takes back to Augustine, a real cleric there, and the church. Anyhow, so, and saying it was anti-Semitic to protest against Israel, even though Jews in outstanding numbers were beginning to do so. So this man has a very serious conflict of interest with me, which is, okay. The world has different kinds of people, but he shouldn't be on the board of the committee that evaluates me. He should recuse himself. That's what it said in the bylaws of the college. That's what it say in the bylaws or constitution of any decent institution. But he didn't do it, and nobody called attention to the fact. And the evaluation was really cooked. You can just read it. It's dripping with innuendo and hostility and calling attention to that I'm sort of losing my grip and so on and so forth. It was the preliminary to letting me go, because I was let go ostensibly on economic grounds, because they needed just only the most productive workers in the faculty to continue handing out high quality education in hard economic times. And this evaluation said that I was no longer a productive worker because my teaching had slipped. There's basically no proof offered of that. It just basically said it. So that's where we're at in the technical part of it, and that lays out the essence of the case as I am experiencing it.
Joel, you must have some supporters within the Bard community, alumni, other faculty?
Well, let's take it one by one. I have a lot of support among alumni, many of whom I've taught. I've been there 21 years. And that's part of it here. This is not the Johnny come lately on the faculty. This is very senior. I was hired as a full professor with an endowed chair. And I've had many very, very strong positive relations with students over the years. And There's a Facebook support Joel Covell page, project, whatever they call it, which has between 500 and 600, you know, people on it. So that's pretty significant support. So that the alumni is good.
What about the faculty?
Not so good. That really gets to the heart of some of this, because we're not just talking about an simple ideologically driven place, but a place that has instilled an enormous amount of timidity and even terror amongst the faculty. And I couldn't believe it. This is supposed to be the second most progressive school in America, behind Mills College, by the way, in Oakland.
Oh, not Hampshire.
No, in case you're wondering. Hampshire was now like 7th or 8th. Second most progressive college, the college that put the liberal in liberal arts, as the Princeton Review said. You know, there was not a single peep of protest against the Israeli invasion and destruction and dropping phosphorus on white phosphorus on helpless people in Gaza. So it's a stunning contradiction. And that's correlating with a couple of things. One is the way in which the school is run over the years, which is ostensibly as a very progressive. And they've done some really interesting things. I don't want to just, cover up a lot of complications. There have been some excellent things, and some things that I've been very grateful for. But there's always a limit, you know. So, but ostensibly progressive, but sort of advanced, but actually run like a medieval, you know, feudal organization, the tyrant who just controls the whole situation. It's a strong way of putting it, but an honest look at the situation would disclose that. And everybody's been saying that for years, but the faculty is intimidated. It's scary. And it's distressing that you can take people who, you know, are sophisticated and have ostensibly good values, and they will not bring themselves to utter basic criticism of an event that has shocked the world and caused, you know, millions of people around the world to change their views about Israel. But you'd never know anything went wrong if you just stayed around Bard College. Serious.
Joel, I've detected a real change in the attitude of a lot of people after the Israeli massacre in Gaza.
Yeah.
And has this affected at all people who are joining your defense?
Well, certainly. Yes, indeed. I wasn't quite sure how to proceed. I just felt since they were not talking to me, I had to do something to call attention to this. So I published my statement, which is on the website.
CODZ.org.
CODZ.org.
It's an amazing statement because it goes through step by step what's happened over the years.
Yeah, a little chronology.
We did that already, right, on this show?
Yeah, I did it, but we can do it again. Let's return to it. But I guess what surprised me is suddenly the legs that it acquired. And did it move around the planet? I mean, this phenomenon that the internet is a vast new resource. And next thing you know, somebody from Croatia is writing me, from Finland, and people from Israel. You know, that's important Israeli academics, writes me and says, this is necessary.
Joel, I understand that Noam Chomsky is scheduled to speak at Bard on March 16th, I believe.
Correct.
Do you think you'll get support from that quarter?
Well, we've corresponded, and, Noam is transparent on these issues. This is the primary value for him. He's fought this 40, 45 years, and he'll continue to do so. You know, we have some differences in the question of Israel, and those differences are worth discussing, but not this context. The context is how much can you openly discuss? How much can you have that out there? Yeah, he intends to do that, although his talk is ostensibly about foreign policy. But the big problem they're going to have is finding a room big enough to hold everybody who wants to show, and that's provoked a little crisis. Of course, a lot of the administrators already discovered very pressing engagements in distant cities that just unfortunately keep them from being there that day. But so that'll open up a chair or two. But they're going to need 1,000 seats, and Bard doesn't have such a hall. But that's not my problem. And he'll show up, and it'll be a memorable event. Let's put it that way.
Joel, do you think the thing that so aggravates them that they've now terminated you is your advocacy of a one-state solution? Do you think that that's the most vital thing in your critique?
Well, in a way, although it's the logic upon which that advocacy is predicated, namely to foreground the critique of Zionism as against the critique of the occupation or Israel's violations of this or that. I mean, that's the perimeter, that's the horizon, so to speak, of acceptable criticism. You can say a fair amount about Israel so long as you don't call the basic structure of the Jewish state into question. And my argument is that however well-intentioned doesn't go nearly far enough and just preserves the monstrosity that is a Zionist state. And my primary issue is Zionism, and if your primary issue is Zionism, you cannot accept a two-state solution. Aside from the fact that the Israelis and the U.S. and so on have wrecked the possibility for it by their settlements and, you know, and all the terrible things they've done in the territories these many years, and despite all the practical difficulties in the way, which are immense, to me, because I think in terms of fundamentals, I think that's secondary, because the primary thing is the logic of Zionism. And it's interesting. Here's Tzvi Lipny, who just, quote, won the election but won't be the next prime minister, saying, because she supports a two-state solution, this was saying in December, she's saying to her fellow citizens of Israel, says, listen, we can have a two-state solution, and then after the two-state solution, we can expel the Palestinians from the Israeli state to the Palestinian Bantustan, because it's not a real state in the two-state. You have to keep that in mind. They don't want an actual state with sovereignty and its own military and foreign policy. They want a Bantustan. They want to raise it to the level of South African apartheid, because it's below that level. So, but if you think about that a moment, there's a two-state solution just allows more ethnic cleansing as far as they're concerned. So obviously, it's insufficient just to talk about a two-state solution. And that's out there. She said that. And very few, when I tell people that, they say, no, she couldn't have said it. Well, of course,
I remember. You're talking to us about it. And this is considered a centrist.
Yeah, that's right.
Livni is considered the centrist. This is the center. I had trouble squaring that with anything that I understand. Yeah.
Right.
No, just the notion that there should be a state for all its citizens. Absolutely. And everybody has equal rights, yeah, is a subversive notion.
Yes, yes, which of course is outrageous. This is the foundation of modern political theory. This is the foundation of our own society. This is the Declaration of Independence. We know that the U.S. still hasn't gotten there, but the point is to have a basic notion that opens a path to getting there. Whereas you get a place like Israel or apartheid South Africa, that path is shut right from the very beginning. And it's that shutting of the path which causes the deepest kind of corruption. So that's why you see Israel lurching further and further to the right. Remember, when this state was founded, it was supposed to be socialist. It had, you know, it was a national liberation movement. It had, you know, all the left celebrate it. You remember, you all sing these songs and, you know, dancing the horror horror, whatever they call it. Now it's a horror horror. And not just drifted into fascism and lurching here and there, but also committing human rights violations on an ever-widening scale. You know, I call it the Macbeth amongst nations. I mean, it starts off with a certain level of criminality, and then it has to keep upping the ante to preserve its fundamental logic. And, of course, you say something like that, you're not currying favor in American academia. You know, so, all right, let it be. Let it be. That's what I say.
I remember right shortly after you were fired, I was reading an article in the New York Times about Bard starting a relationship with Al-Quds University.
Yeah.
Al-Quds is the Arabic word for Jerusalem,
as I recall.
Yeah, Al-Quds, yes. And they've started this relationship with the university in the occupied territories or East Jerusalem, And I guess the question for me is, what do you say to something like that? And what do I think?
Yeah.
Of course, in the light, here they fire like a guy who has very important ideas to make, opens that campus a little, and at the same time, with the other hand, they're saying Al-Quds.
Yeah. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. I actually have been restraining myself about it because I don't feel I understand the situation well enough. But what I would certainly say is that it has to be questioned the way any kind of intervention of this sort, particularly in a colonial situation, has to be questioned. In other words, is this a genuine opening towards the emancipation of the Palestinians, or is it a co-optation of Palestinians into the greater Israel? You know, are they creating a new class of compliant bourgeoisie who would, you know, get the jobs and the auto dealerships or the Burger Kings or whatever they're planning? And, you know, I don't know, but I know that those questions have to be asked. And I know some of the people working on it, and they're really nice people. You know, it's typical of a quote, liberal institution to use generous impulses and people with ideals and the like. They want to make something good happen. But we also know how many pitfalls there are, how much a project of that sort can just become another neo-colonial enterprise, you know, where the, just think of all the universities that were founded by the British and the French in order to secure their empires. I think it has a lot to do with that. But that's just an opinion. That's not really a very firm one, and so I haven't really spoken out on it. I think one motivation for easing me out of there would be to get rid of someone who is likely to ask these kinds of fundamental questions, because I guarantee you no one else in Bard is likely to ask questions of that sort, which are embarrassing. And that's just some speculation on my part. But it's a very complex and interesting issue. Botstein thinks of this as the fulfillment of Zionism. He says, look, see, Zionism, we can have a flourishing Jewish state and also flourishing Palestinian civil society. I think it's perhaps a little more complex than that.
Well, Joel Covell, you're very courageous. It's hard to be fired from a job.
No, it's
and
not,
it's hard
it's
to
not,
be isolated from a faculty. And it's hard to be slandered and libeled the way you have
yes,
been.
It's been
and
happy, yes.
You have our support here at Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
The website, codz.org, has a list of things people can do to help you.
Right.
Letters can be written. The addresses are there. There's a PayPal there. There's a big rally in New York coming up.
Right.
We're behind you, Joel Covell.
Okay, thank
Good
you.
Luck.
Thank you. Just give us a few days because the website is still in progress. So if it's not much today, come back in a few days. We're working on it.
Joel, it's been a pleasure to have you on once again, and we look forward to
hearing
more updates.
Yeah, there will be more. Okay, guys.
Thanks once again, Joel.
And thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Last week, the Justice Department released internal Bush documents that revealed more legal memos authorizing torture and interrogation outside of the United States. In what is effectively a blueprint for a police state, as we've discussed on Law & Disorder, other memos include the military search, detention, or trial of civilians in the United States without congressional input. And a newly disclosed opinion by torture memo author John Yoo, who argued that constitutional provisions ensuring free speech and barring warrantless searches could be disregarded by the president in wartime. This is stunning material. And to talk about it, we're joined now by attorney Scott Horton, who is also the contributing editor to Harper's Magazine.
Scott Horton, welcome to Law & Disorder. Scott, as I said to you earlier, you know, I think we're catching up with these guys, with the bad guys. More and more is coming out all the time. And we're here to really talk about some of the latest, and I know you're the world's expert on it, and that's the recent, what you call a memo dump in one of your emails to me, OLC, Office of Legal Counsel memos. Why don't you run through what happened, why is it significant?
Well, I think we start with the why. Why are these documents being released? Of course, the Congress and the public have been demanding release of these secret OLC memos for a long time. In fact, it's been practice of the Department of Justice for more than a century to publish the memos. So it's a departure from that practice that the Bush administration kept them secret. Nevertheless, the Bush administration did keep them secret all the way to the end. Even the Obama transition team went in trying to see these memos and were told pointedly and repeatedly, you can't have them, you can't see them. one of the pledges that Barack Obama made in the course of the campaign was he was going to reverse this policy, secret memos in the legal counsel's office, and that he was going to publish the memos that were there. Of course, they had to be reviewed for removal of attorney-client sensitive material and secrets and things like that before they're published. But the group that was released, we know that they were moved forward in the group for release because they've been sought in litigation, particularly a lawsuit called Padilla versus Yu, which is a civil lawsuit seeking damages against John Yu based on legal advice he gave that resulted in Jose Padilla being tortured. And in fact, when we look at the set of memos released, two of them deal specifically with the Padilla case.
What do you mean? They actually talk about Padilla?
Well, they talk about an American citizen who's been detained, so it's pretty obvious that it's Padilla that they're talking about. And as I understand, these things were released and published because they were sought in the litigation. They are turned over, so they were within the scope of the request.
So what does it say about Padilla, though?
Not surprisingly. I mean, Padilla was treated as basically as a combatant. He was taken out of the criminal justice system. He was held and he was put back into the criminal justice system. And we know he was treated in special isolation. He was denied access to counsel at different points. So all the things that the Bush administration did to Padilla appear to have been authorized through these OLC memoranda.
Now, Scott, how many memos are we talking about?
It's in this batch, it's 9 altogether.
One of them, I recall, and maybe you'll run through them, one of them talks about, oh, I guess the ability of the Bush administration to drop a bomb on my house. Is
exactly.
That right?
Yeah, I would say that's a memorandum from October 25, 2001. And out of this entire set, that was, to me, the one that was most captivating. I mean, there were sentences that just kept leaping off the page as I read it. For instance, it says, the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable searches and seizures simply doesn't apply if the president engages in what it calls domestic military operations. And it also says, and by the same token, the First Amendment doesn't apply. These protections of speech and press are irrelevant, and they have to be subordinated to the military strategy that the president adopts. And it says the Posse Comitatus Act is essentially a dead letter. So a number of really astonishing conclusions.
You know, this was interesting because, you know, I always use the term for the memo of November 13th, 2001, the public memo, executive order number 1, not memo, that said the president could pick up anyone anywhere in the world, any non-citizen, and hold them. I always called that the coup d'etat memo. And when you read these, you realize that it's no exaggeration. I mean, basically what they did in this one memo you're referring to is say 200 years of constitutional history and law is gone. I mean, that's all. I don't know what else to say.
I think that's right. And Jack Balkin up at Yale, who's done a very interesting post about this, calls this the guidebook for a presidential dictatorship. Yeah. And that's exactly right. Of course, John Yu is out busily defending himself today. He gave an interview in the Orange County Register in which he says, you know, I was just giving frank and unvarnished advice to my client. And, of course, whether he chooses to act on that advice is entirely up to him. Now, that's nonsensical. I mean, you know, of course, what these memos have an instrumental role. That is, they fix when they're issued. They set the legal policy of the administration. That's in accordance with the Judiciary Act of 1789. So, in essence, you can call these things secret laws. That's the consequence of their being issued. So we're seeing a Justice Department that is essentially overturning the Constitution.
That, I agree, is pretty clearly the worst of the memos. Any other ones you want to emphasize for our listeners?
Well, the other one that I think is fascinating, I mean, we have two memos in this group that were authored by Stephen Bradbury that basically, in which he distances himself from the prior memos. And, of course, the New York Times reported, and their editorial today states that Bradbury is rescinding these prior memos. I'm not really sure that's the case. I mean, you go in and look at the wording in that Bradbury memo. He's very cautious about how he approaches these prior memos. He says, well, people haven't broadly relied on them, you know, and they haven't really been relied on for a while. There are always these qualifiers in there. And then he distances himself from specific statements in the memos. So he doesn't really anywhere say that he's withdrawn the memo or it's rescinded or anything like that. So I think we have to be cautious about these qualifications of them. And you know, what's the purpose of Bradbury's doing this? I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, he does this on his way out the door, just as he's leaving. And then there's a footnote in the memorandum in which he refers specifically to the prospect of bar disciplinary or ethics proceedings. And he says that all the criticisms he makes shouldn't be taken by anyone as in support of, you know, disciplinary action involving John Yoo or the other attorneys who are involved. And I think that footnote is a dead giveaway about what's going on. Of course, we know that there's an Office of Professional Responsibility investigation ongoing into a number of the OLC memoranda. The Office of Professional Responsibility is the ethics watchdog inside the Justice Department. We know that investigation started in 2004. We know there were several efforts by the Bush administration to shut it down. And we know that in October, the first week of October, a preliminary report was completed that was shared with Deputy Attorney General Phillip and Attorney General Mukasey. And we know that they went bananas when they saw it. They were very, very upset. Evidently, this report castigates Yoo, Bybee, and Bradbury over their memo writing, and evidently it discloses also a number of background facts about the memos, how they came to be created, who was involved in the process, and it severely criticizes them over this. This report could be quite explosive, of course, because the Bush administration has prepared a blanket defense to war crimes accusations of reliance on counsel, and specifically its reliance on these OLC memoranda. And that defense is a sort of equitable defense, so it's very much dependent upon the facts. If the Department of Justice's own internal probe concludes that these memoranda were conceived from the beginning as, and I'll use a technical term, CYA memos.
Exactly.
Then they really are not effective to protect the people who requested them. I think that's what's going on here. And I think specifically now with respect to this January 15, 2009 memorandum, I've been told that Bradbury was interviewed by the OPR lawyers working on the report. He was pressed repeatedly for an explanation as to why he had not rescinded these various Yoo memoranda. And I was told that he gave an evasive and incredible response. So it seems pretty clear that he knows that the OPR people are going to criticize him over leaving these memoranda in place. So his departing shot, sort of distancing himself from him, seems to be an act of self-defense.
Right. It was written after the interview with OPR is what it sounds like.
Exactly. And he's defending himself against the criticisms that they're leveling.
One question is, do we expect more memos to be released?
Yes. In fact, I'm told that that within 2 weeks we will see more being released. I'm also told that there is a priority project that's been set up by Don Johnson and Marty Lederman and David Barron, the trio who are running OLC now, which is to sort through all these unpublished opinions and get them published.
Scott Horton, one thought scares me, and that is, to what extent do these memos still govern current practices?
And the answer to that has got to be, I'm not sure. We don't know fully. I would say we know that one of the executive orders that Barack Obama issued directing a study about interrogation techniques, for instance, it explicitly says that in doing this review and in formulating policy, they are not to be guided by any of these Bush-era OLC opinions, unless otherwise instructed by the administration. There seems to be a presumption that he's set out in his executive orders that all these memoranda are invalid. But, you know, I think that needs to be more formal. And one of the things I think is going to be happening in connection with this publication is that OLC is going to be reviewing and rescinding or repudiating a large number of these memoranda. And I'm told, actually, that they put a priority on publishing them because they welcome public participation in this process. They want to see law professors and practitioners and, you know, public policy scholars look at these documents, criticize them, and allow this sort of public discussion to guide them to some extent and the decision about what to do with these abominations.
Scott, I have one last question, and it's related to the memos in a way and to what you talked about legal defense. I get asked all the time, and I know you do, is, well, can you really prosecute John Yoo for the torture memos and for these other memos? Wasn't he just giving legal advice? And he really believed the legal advice. He was an honest broker in the sense that these were his ideas before he took office. What's wrong with that argument, if there's anything wrong with it?
You look at his public statements, of which there have been hundreds since he left the Justice Department, he seems to fully understand that that's an acceptable legal defense because everything he says is geared to this, that's my honest opinion, and it's never changed. It's still my honest opinion, right? But is that argument correct? No, it's not correct. I'd start with the fact that even if we're just looking under good old domestic American law, the facts and circumstances surrounding the issuance of these opinions is critical. He says that, you know, he was asked his opinion, he gave his honest opinion, that's his viewpoint, they relied on it. I think that what we're going to see is that he was told in meetings in the White House, well before he wrote these opinions, that a torture program had been put in place, that it was being implemented, that pushback had come from other lawyers in the administration who were saying, career lawyers, who were saying, this is unlawful conduct. And he was told, we need to protect ourselves on this, and we need you to write a memorandum to protect us. And we also need that memorandum in order to cram down these other government lawyers who are talking about this and making our people nervous. That suggests that there's an instrumental role played by his opinions, that they were done to silence critical lawyers and to help push the torture program, which had already been set in motion, forward. And if that's the case, he's made himself a part of the conspiracy to introduce torture under 2340A. He's playing an instrumental role, not merely a role as advisor. And in fact, the Code of Professional Responsibility understands that distinction and says, you know, to lawyers, you can't do that. You can't do that in the course of writing an opinion. You have to be very, very cautious that you're not telling people how to go about committing a crime and protect themselves from criminal investigation. That's not appropriate. So I'd say he's in very, very serious trouble. And then aside from American law, we've got international law where it's very well established that there is no defense of reliance on counsel. That's in essence the Nuremberg defense, which the U.S. repudiated and international law has long repudiated. And a lawyer giving this sort of advice and misstating or corrupting the law is also potentially liable directly for war crimes. That's the precedent of the United States against Altstadler, a case that the U.S. prosecuted at the end of World War II against lawyers.
So, Scott, would you conclude, therefore, that instead of sitting and teaching law at the University of California, John Yoo should be disbarred, and moreover, Jay Bybee, who's a Court of Appeals judge in the federal system, shouldn't be there either?
Well, let's wait and see what the OPR report says. I'm led to believe that OPR is recommending bar disciplinary action against John Yoo, that they've made a concrete recommendation to that effect. And if that's the case, you know, will it be disbarment or reprimand? I'm not sure. I mean, but, you know, in any event, serious action. And if serious action is begun against him by a bar, there's a question as to whether he can remain as a professor at the University of California. In fact, you go look at the University of California rules, and disciplinary action by a professional oversight panel is a basis for removing a professor, even a tenured professor.
That's good to hear, Scott. I'm glad to hear that.
I remember Nixon was disbarred from New York State.
Bill Clinton was disbarred from Arkansas.
Oh, that's
true. I didn't know that.
We've had lots of disbarred presidents. I think, you know, the most likely outcome of all this is that we're going to see a lot of disbarments.
That's good to hear.
That's a good start. Yeah. And characters like us are running around, and these guys are getting disbarred. It'll be a good day.
Scott, we really want to thank you. It's great. Scott is our foremost expert on illegalities of the Bush administration, particularly around torture. So it's great to have you, Scott.
Hey,
thanks,
my
Scott.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Shortly after we interviewed Jonathan Heifetz, the Supreme Court came down with its decision in the El Mari case.
In a way, it was a bit of a surprise. Pretty good, not perfect. Here's what they did. They agreed that the case was mooted out, that El-Mari could be removed as an enemy combatant from the prison and from his status as an enemy combatant, and tried as a so-called regular criminal indictment and tried on that. That, of course, was not good enough for Jonathan Heifetz or for any of us, because it still would have allowed the government to hold him as an enemy combatant if and when he's acquitted or his time is served. So the Supreme Court went a little farther. They said that the Fourth Circuit decision, which had upheld El-Mari's status as an enemy combatant, had to be vacated. They wiped it off the books. So there's no longer a decision out there in the courts, in the circuit, saying a person in the United States can be held as an enemy combatant. So it's roughly half the loaf. Here's why it's half the loaf. While it got rid of a bad decision in the Fourth Circuit, it didn't get rid of the president's power to still hold people as enemy combatants. And the Obama administration, in its brief, still essentially insisted they might well have that right to hold people as enemy combatants. What Jonathan Heifetz wanted, what we wanted at the Center for Constitutional Rights, what civil liberties lawyers wanted, was actually not just a vacating of the Fourth Circuit ruling, but we actually wanted it reversed. We wanted a decision saying you could hold people as an enemy combatant reversed. We don't have that yet. So as the law now stands, the president still has, if he asserts it, and if he believes it, a power to hold a person in the United States as an enemy combatant without any court decision saying he does not. So it may be a while until that's tested again. It's possible Obama will never test it again and try and hold anybody in as an enemy combatant. But at the same time, he's not giving up the power to do so. So it's half of loaf. It's a little better than we had expectations for, but it's still the Obama administration holding on to some of the Bush policies with regard to detaining people as enemy combatants. A mixed opinion. Today, we're happy to have with us Jonathan Heifetz, who has been El-Mari's lawyer forever, essentially since the day he was, as I recall, first indicted and then swept out of the courtroom as an American enemy combatant. Jonathan, welcome to Law and Disorder. Jonathan, we've had you on a few times, bringing us up to date on the El-Mari case, who's the only remaining, or was, or maybe still is in a way, the only remaining U.S. domestic enemy combatant. I know you lost the case 5-4 in the Court of Appeals in the circuit, and it was on its way. In fact, cert had been granted in the Supreme Court, and you were getting ready, submitted your brief, getting ready to argue the case.
Well, the argument's scheduled for April 27th.
Right. And then something has happened since the Obama administration has taken office. What's happened with El-Mari?
Well, the government's brief is due on March 23rd. What happened was on last Friday, February 27th, the government unsealed an indictment that had just been filed in the Central District of Illinois, charging Mr. El-Mari with two counts of material support for terrorism, effectively returning him to the civilian justice system where he'd been removed unlawfully and put in military detention almost 6 years ago. At the same time the government filed the indictment, they filed a motion in the Supreme Court asking to the court to dismiss Mr. El-Mari's appeal, claiming it was moot because he was now being charged with a crime, which is the primary relief that we'd been seeking in the habeas petition.
Now, this was an appeal that was going in the Supreme Court that was going to test the power of the president to detain as unlawful enemy combatants people in the United States. Is that right?
This sweeping claim of executive power that the president could seize and militarily detain, potentially for life without trial, any individual, including a U.S. Legal resident or an American citizen, based on the assertion that they were involved in terrorist activities. And this policy, which the Bush administration had been pressing virtually since 9/11, was finally being called into account in the Supreme Court, and the Obama administration effectively refused to defend the policy, and by charging El-Mari and sought to short-circuit the Supreme Court review.
John, this is, what Bush did with Padilla also, right?
It's
the Padilla case was like El-Mari in the Supreme Court.
We all complained then, this is like you're not giving the Supreme Court a chance to test this bad policy. Got to straighten us out here.
Yeah, I think it's you know, unfortunately, I mean, it's certainly a positive step that they did this and they are charging Mr. Almari, but I think it's incomplete, and I think there are some very, you know, troubling analogies to what the Bush administration did in the Padilla case. In their motion paper in the Supreme Court, when they are seeking to have the case thrown out of the Supreme Court, the Obama administration did not renounce the policy. That is, they are trying to shield this policy of military detention from review, but at the same time, they're not renouncing it. So they're trying, you know, they're basically leaving their options open to continue it in the future while ducking court review of that policy.
And what have you done legally?
Well, we filed March 3rd a response, an opposition to the government's motion saying that the case is not moot because while the government has charged Mr. Almari, it has not renounced its policy or practice of militarily detaining U.S. residents or American citizens within the United States. And in fact, it has not even said that it will not re-detain Mr. Almari at the end of his criminal proceeding, whether he's acquitted or if he's convicted after he's sentenced. So it's trying to keep all its cards, all its options open, while avoiding a review of this repugnant and unlawful policy that's been in place since 9/11.
So when do you expect to hear what the Supreme Court will do?
I think we'll hear very quickly from the Supreme Court one way or the other, if nothing else, because the government's brief would be due to defend the position, if that's what they were going to do, on March 23rd.
It's not all over for Almari, because as you just said, even if he goes to trial and is acquitted, or if he gets time served or some short sentence, right now, as we speak, the administration still thinks, or at least is asserting, if not asserting, at least leaving on the books, the right to hold him as an enemy combatant. Is that right?
The government's view, if he could be re-detained at some future point, even after his criminal trial. So one of the other thing we asked for in our opposition is that even if the court dismisses the case as moot, it must take one measure, prophylactic measure, which is to effectively overturn the lower court's decision upholding the president's power so that decision is not on the books. And at least we have a blank slate in terms of going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, Jonathan, thank you very much. We've been following this for a long time. I guess in one way it's a pretty big break. It's what you were looking for on one level, but it's not home yet, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.